It is Helping Hand, weekly feature airing statewide on HPR1 stations on Fridays as part of our afternoon drive broadcast of All Things Considered, and then archived online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's where all of our Helping Hand segments and resources are archived. Every week, Helping Hand puts a spotlight on an organization, topic, or event that offers assistance to people with disabilities and people and animals who are among the most vulnerable. I'm Dave Lawrence. Thank you for joining us. This week, we are thrilled to be learning about the efforts of one of the leading wildlife conservation organizations. They're called WildAid. In fact, you may even know their name because they're pretty big. WildAid's a nonprofit focused on ending the wildlife trade. They have a unique way they do it. They're based in San Francisco, but it's a global organization. A method they've become known for is using Asian celebrities and public service messaging campaigns in the Asia Pacific to try and reduce demand for wildlife products, basically behavior changes with people like basketball star Yao Ming, actor Jackie Chan, many others, in video, print ads, other public signage that encourages people in these countries not to buy products like shark fins, pangolins, pangolin scales, rhino horn, elephant ivory, that sort of thing. They have a 4 out of 4 rating from Charity Navigator, and today we are learning about two specific areas of their work. A recent partnership with the University of Hong Kong to conduct a survey regarding use of endangered wildlife products like pangolins, the most trafficked mammal on Earth, which few people in America have even heard of. And another campaign with Japanese nonprofit Tears of the African Elephant. It's focused on ending the Japanese ivory trade ahead of the 2020 Olympics. And Japan's ivory trade, we will hear, is causing devastation. Many of the countries in the region have had much more of a devastating impact and have started to move towards bans and changes. But Japan very quietly continues to allow this Hanko seal trade in ivory. And we're going to hear a lot more about it from somebody who's certainly an expert on what's happening and trying to bring a halt to it. It is the CEO from WildAid, Peter Knights, joining us on Helping Hand today. Aloha and mahalo, Peter. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for letting me appear on the show. It's a privilege, and I always spend my holidays in Hawaii, so my heart is in Hawaii.
It's a nice thing to hear. Well, the next time you're here, we've got to rope you into coming by the studio, do a little little follow-up thing. And first, I guess, fill in the rest of the story I may have missed in introducing you and basically explain to folks what WildAid's mission is.
Well, you hit it on the button there. I mean, we uniquely have been focusing on trying to reduce the demand for endangered species products. Most organizations in conservation are trying to protect the supply. We would argue if the demand is strong, just like with the drugs trade, you're not going to make much impact. And so you have to hit the demand. And over the last 15 years or so, we've been working in Asia. And although these problems still seem to go on, there's been incredible changes and incredible impact on that demand. So, you know, the public in Asia now is highly sensitized to endangered species issues, which is probably not what many people in the United States think, but it is the case. And we've seen an 80% reduction in 3 years on the imports of shark fin, for example. Some of those shark fins were coming from Hawaii until we had the shark finning ban there, which we were part of. On the ivory trade, the price of ivory in some cases is down 80 or 90% from what it was 3 or 4 years ago. And even rhino horn, which is still a sought-after product, is down about 60 or 70% in terms of the price. And this just means that the people in the field who are out there risking their lives to protect these animals, they got a better chance when the prices are lower. There's less money for corruption. The drives are less. Some of the people involved in the illegal wildlife trade switch to other trades because it's not commercially successful enough.
And that's a great point. The last thing you said is if you can just put enough pressure on these people, they might say, you know what, it's easier to do this other illegal activity instead of chasing the rhinos around, is essentially.
That's the game. Unfortunately, you can't stop bad people doing bad things necessarily. But if you make it, on the one hand, less profitable, and on the other hand, you work on the enforcement side and make the risk of capture more increased, then very often these people go off and do some other nefarious activity, unfortunately. But we've got to hold the line that we can.
Yeah, it's a very good. And from talking with Andrea Crosta, who has been in Elephant Action League, now a new organization, their name is escaping me at the moment, but it is sort of what you said. It's a multi-pronged attack, and if you're not doing all of them at once, you're seriously going to be in trouble. And some of these animals, literally, like when it comes to certainly the rhinos, they literally almost need a person with them 24 hours a day to keep
them
safe.
Well, many of them have that, Dave. Many of them do have to have 24-hour personal protection. And sadly, even that in some cases, sometimes they cut off most of the horn and still the animals are being poached. So you've got to work all the angles at the same time. And I think the good news is we've seen when you can do that successfully, if you have good laws, you have good enforcement, and you also work on educating the potential consumers, you can make a big impact. So recently, you know, the ivory poaching, for example, in Kenya, has gone down from 400 elephants a year to around 50. And that's partly as a result of better enforcement, better laws, better judicial sentencing, but also because the demand's gone down at the same time. So you need to employ all these tools at the same time if you're going to succeed.
Absolutely. And before we get into some of these two of your many projects that we're going to focus on today, how does WildAid get funding?
Well, we get foundation funding, we get a very small amount of government funding, and we get from the public generally. And so we're not a small membership organization. We have a relatively small number of donors who support us. And because we do that in a very efficient way, we're able to, as you noted, we have 4-star rating, but we're also the only wildlife charity that currently has 100% rating from Charity Navigator for efficiency and transparency. So we're very proud of that. And we make sure the dollars go a long way. Well, our biggest donor, in fact, in kind, is actually the government of China, who state media donates about $200 million worth of free media space to us every year. So we're able to do these massive campaigns, as you alluded to, which are on TV, they're on billboards, they're all over the place. And we do it at a fraction of the cost because all the media space itself has been donated by the media.
Well, that's a positive one to hear, considering all the negative news we hear about the consumption in that country. Your history with defending wildlife is not something new, but probably new to the folks listening to us. Give a little bit, if you can, just a summary of your background and why you're so passionate. A lot of people have an animal nearby. You might have fish on the counter. You may have a dog by your feet. There's such an intense feeling you get from any animal. And when you get a mass of people all getting more passionate about them, that feeds into what we're talking about of making a change. Tell us about how you got passionate like this.
Well, and I think that's why I didn't start out going down the animal route. I wanted to try in my life in some tiny little way make the world a slightly better place. And I do think that, you know, obviously we're in the U.S. right now. We're a very divided country, very unfortunately. But I do think what will bring people together across the world is the environment, because it's something we all have to share. And I think there is a universal love for animals. And I think animals are very much part of our humanity. And if we lose them, and what we do when we do bad things to them, we lose some of our own humanity in it. So it's an area that I got into originally as an undercover investigator. So I was doing investigations into illegal wildlife trade, where we would have fake business cards and set up fake businesses and use hidden cameras and do this undercover research and do exposés of what was going on. A lot of my work to begin with was on the wild bird trade, parrots that were being imported largely to the United States and things like that as pets. Many of them were dying on the way. They were destroying the nesting trees to get the baby parrots. It was a complete disaster. And it was largely a question of ignorance. People that were buying them had no idea where these animals were coming from and what was happening. And so a lot of this stuff is ignorance. It is about just showing the consumer at the end, you know, the chain of actions that they've set off by buying these products. And that's really where we ended up moving to WildAid, where it was very clear when we were doing the investigations that, you know, enforcement is always going to be under-resourced, and you can't solve problems with enforcement alone. You know, the drugs trade spent like $23 trillion on trying to fight drugs, and then they're as strong as they ever were. We spent very little on trying to address the demand for drugs. And so we, as we were seeing this, we decided the expose was one element, but exposés, you're in the news for a day, it goes away, media moves on to something else, everybody thinks the problem's solved, you haven't solved the problem. We needed something much more pervasive, much more longer term, and much more persuasive. And so we developed this model, which is, you know, a model that's used by almost every business in the world, an advertising model. If you want to increase demand, you promote, you advertise. If you're lucky, you get celebrity endorsers to push your brand and things. And in our case, the brand is not WildAid, the brand is no buying, no killing, as our phrase is in Chinese. So it's about getting that idea out. And luckily, or perhaps by design, the first person I managed to get on board was Jackie Chan. And of course, he's been an absolutely marvelous spokesperson. He's still working with us today. And he was just delighted to come on board and be part of the campaign because he knew a little bit about some of the problems, but nobody had ever given him anything he could do about it. And so by getting Jackie on board, we now have over 300 ambassadors. It really is a who's who of Chinese celebrities, Vietnamese celebrities, Thai celebrities. Here in the States, people like Leo DiCaprio, Edward Norton, you know, a whole panorama of different people that have supported this cause. And the campaign's been ongoing now for 15 years. I think it's one of the longest running and certainly one of the most widespread campaigns ever. And it's been supported by this fantastic free media. We use sort of Madison Avenue style advertising techniques, CGI, speeding bullets and things like that to make, I hope, the advertising interesting and engaging. And that's enabled us to engage a massive amount of public support for the media rollout, which means the campaigns are on a line with a Coca-Cola campaign rather than an obscure NGO campaign, as some of them tend to be.
It's incredible what you've done. And it's were you the one who thought of tapping the celebs to do this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, when we've done this investigation stuff, we're like, how do we get something that's coming out not, you know, once every 6 months you have expose, but in people's sitting rooms every week? And it was the obvious, other obvious thing was we needed to have in Asia, Asian people talking to Asians. And, you know, nobody wants to be lectured by someone from outside your country. So we had to find ambassadors from those communities. And what has been, I think, amazing and overpowering to me is, you know, we just tapped into something that was already there. All these people cared about animals. They wanted to do something, and nobody ever gave them a mechanism by which they could use their popularity to sort of catalyze things. And so we were kind of that catalyst. And after we had a few people signed up, people started approaching us saying, we'd like to do something for you. And it's been incredible, the amount of people we've got on board. We're now working a lot in Africa, and we've got a who's who of African celebrities now coming on board to push the other end of the thing, which is the poaching, and to try and persuade governments to get tougher on the poaching. We're trying to get the public in Africa to visit their own national parks more, because it's quite amazing now. A lot of middle-class Africans have never been to their national parks, which, you know, we go over there and spend thousands of dollars to go and see these places, and they're right on their doorstep, and they haven't been. So we're, you know, trying to promote that with people like Lupita Nyong'o, Denai Gurira, Jaimon Hounsou, really the A-list of African celebrities coming on board.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's just so inspiring to listen to you talk. It's incredible. I can't tell you how proud I am of you, that whole campaign. And to watch Jackie Chan, like in the one with the pangolins, and it's like,
yeah.
If any animal needs somebody like him to step up to the plate and help them, that creature does. And to see somebody,
absolutely,
to see somebody doing it for such a vulnerable animal. And that's a good lead in to this thing here. So you've recently been sharing some results, and we talked about this recently on the show, did a segment about it, and it's a survey. It was based around one of Earth's most vulnerable residents, bar none, the pangolin. It's a tiny, mm-hmm, scaled mammal. It's about the size of a house cat. It does not have teeth. It has claws, but it really is not a violent animal. It is essentially defenseless, the only mammal with scales, a creature few people know about in the United States. It's being eaten into extinction, primarily in China and Vietnam, but elsewhere in the Asia Pacific and wherever Asia Pacific nationals are, to a lesser degree. Give a summary, I guess, of the crisis, but also what you guys did in terms of this teaming up with the university in Hong Kong, mm-hmm, and what seems to be guardedly positive results of this survey.
Mm. Well, we've always been blown away with the survey results we've had in Asia regarding wildlife trade issues. I think there is, I mean, part of one of the reasons I sort of started on this work was when I was out there doing the investigations, what I found in people in Asia, when you talk to them, when they had the information, they cared just as much as anyone would in the United States or Europe about wildlife. It's just nobody was asking them and nobody was talking to them about it. And so the recent survey we've done, 85% of the respondents in Hong Kong thought that the laws should be more strictly enforced on endangered wildlife. Two-thirds thought the Chinese government should be doing more, sorry, the government of Hong Kong should be doing more to educate people about endangered species. And two-thirds thought that the public should, the Chinese medicine should phase out the use of pangolins in traditional Chinese medicine, as they have done with the rhino horn trade. So the public, and when we were doing in China the ivory campaign, 95% of people thought the ivory trade should be banned in Hong Kong. Well, I don't think, in China. I don't think you get those sort of figures in the United States or Europe. There's a tremendous groundswell of support and sympathy for endangered species, but there's a small number of people who continue to use these products and promote them. And so we do these surveys partly to indicate to the governments that there is this groundswell of support, and by taking stronger conservation action, they have the support of the broad public to move things forward.
And on the note of Hong Kong, which because we're sort of the gateway to the Asia Pacific, whenever these mega seizures happen, I report on them on All Things Considered because of, if we were in Vermont, I don't know if it would be the exact same thing. But certainly on a note of just wildlife and trouble, it would be relevant. But here it seems very, very relevant. And some of these seizures are 10 tons, 9. Yeah, it's almost, it would make me so upset I wouldn't even be able to do the interview.
Well, if you go to Africa, which is where most of the pangolins now are left, most of the Asian pangolins have been wiped out, none of the guides, none of the rangers, the people we work with in Africa, none of them have ever seen a wild pangolin because these are very elusive animals. They're nocturnal. They're very slow reproducing. And you just have to ask, where are they getting these animals from? Because you're seeing shipments that represent 20 or 30,000 animals. 11.9 tons of pangolin scales were seized with 8 tons of ivory in Singapore a few weeks ago. And it just beggars belief where they're finding these animals, let alone trading them. And so nobody really knows how many pangolins are out there. We do know they reproduce very slowly. We do also know that they do not really produce in captivity. So there's been a lot of zoos and breeding places trying to breed pangolins, in some cases trying to do it commercially. And they've only bred a few dozen pangolins in decades. And so clearly you can't supply that trade through captive breeding. So we have to, we have to look at the wild animals, and they are being decimated. They're now protected everywhere internationally. We do have a loophole in the law, though, unfortunately, in China, where although it's illegal to import pangolin scales, it's not illegal to sell pangolin scales. And so that was the same loophole we had with the ivory trade. And we really need to get that loophole closed to be able to really help the pangolins out, because it could be in the next 10, 15 years, the rate we're going, we could lose them completely.
Or even sooner with this crazy numbers. You just can't even, especially considering how tiny the creature is and it's just their scales. I mean, the volume is, it's enough to make you pass out. And so people listening, there's undoubtedly, a large group of folks driving home right now. This is afternoon drive that this plays. And a lot of people with resources who have been fortunate in their lives to own nice homes and have cars and jobs and ability to help. And so when people are hearing you now and maybe are outraged by what's happened to these highly vulnerable, innocent creatures that cannot defend themselves, what can people listening do to help push real changes in Hong Kong and expand that to China? And that could be either supporting your organization through donations. Mm-hmm. It could be volunteering to be your outreach through social media. It could be writing to politicians. It could be boycotting travel to certain countries or spending their money in certain countries. What are the ways people listening can be... can help out?
Well, I think, it is about information and support. Obviously, conservation needs support in the field with people protecting the animals in the field and doing the public awareness, the work of people like ourselves at WildAid. Financial support is always needed for those things. But you can be an ambassador yourself. You can put out information through your social media, through your networks. You can follow what's going on with pangolins and put it into your social media. We put out a lot of stuff in newsletters. And try, and if you have friends in Asia, is try and get them worked up and supportive of it. Things have really, really changed. So there was a case a few months ago where an individual went to Vietnam from China, bought some pangolins, and put on his social media he was eating pangolin meat. It got a huge outrage. He was fired by his company. Something like 6 million people on social media condemned him and said he should be arrested and things like that. So there is a sensibility there. We've just got to keep pushing until we get the legislative change that we need, and then it's about awareness, and ultimately if these things become socially unacceptable to consume them, that is what makes the change. And we've had a lot of cases where people have said grandchildren have impacted. Very often it's the older generation that's consuming these products, and their grandchildren have told them you can't do this anymore, and they've listened to their grandchildren. So children too can have a part to play in this. In fact, one of our ambassadors currently is Kung Fu Panda, Po the Panda, who is amazingly speaks many different languages, but has been great in trying to get kids on board to sort of push this messaging.
And is it, besides the behavioral change, is it realistic to imagine that one day the legislative action will be so severe that it will entice people not to do it? And I mean, for example, it would be a capital offense.
No, and personally, I'm not in favor of capital punishment for any crime, but I think the thing is just having meaningful punishment. So recently, there was someone in Hong Kong smuggling. They went to jail for a year. So that might not sound mild to you, but compared to what we've had for wildlife in the past, it's been a small fine, which can just be a cost of doing business. So things are getting better on that level. And as the judiciary gets more aware of this, again, they're putting in serious sentences because there is a knock-on effect. It's not just about the animals dying. In many cases, it's an economic effect as well. If you look at the ivory poaching, elephants generate millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars for Africa as a tourist attraction. If they're poached, you can't have that. So it is beyond, and that's our message very much in Africa, is poaching steals from us all. That isn't just the loss of the animal, which in itself is obviously very bad. It's actually economic theft of the country as well. So you have to look at it on those grounds. So things are getting more serious for sure. And it is a combination of reducing that demand so the prices go down. That's the biggest factor in my personal opinion. The less money people are making this, the less attractive it is. And then the higher risk, not just of receiving a serious fine, but also being caught. So we've been really pleased and excited to do a major campaign in China on ivory with the customs this year. And I walked into Beijing Airport last time. Between getting off the plane and going through the customs, I saw 20 of these posters with a customs officer holding ivory saying, "This is now contraband." And so that kind of in-your-face, we are not tolerating it anymore, I think is very, very important. And ultimately, we then see that reflected down the line with further price drops and also with the reduction in poaching in Africa. So it's by no means a hopeless situation here. We're seeing great progress. And I think, China has made huge progress. And China, obviously, the size of the country, the size of the economy, was a major, major factor. And seeing them coming out the other side is very encouraging. It's also a generational thing. And as the older generations move out, so the younger people are not nearly as much into this. And we will get beyond this. We face other threats beyond that, of course, such as climate change, habitat loss. So the longer term threats, these animals are not out of the woods, even if we can stop the trade. And it's that combination of all these threats, it really is a scary factor.
Well, that's great with that. I know that public service campaign you're talking about with that Chinese actor dressed as a customs agent, because we talked to every time you guys do a new thing, we do a new story on it. And that one was fantastic to see.
And that's it's run in every port and every airport. Right. And now customs is putting it onto every plane coming into China. So when they get on this, they do an incredible job. And I think that campaign will actually be held up as an example to other governments around the world. If you want to get serious about this, this is what you do.
It's an impressive one. And we've talked a bit about the ivory in China, which has been a huge thing. Similarly on Japan, this is one where many people who love animals travel there. They spend money on the country. There's a lot to see and do, and they're a major player in the international community. But like a lot of the countries that are driving these extinction crises, people might feel differently about spending their dollars in certain places if they knew what was going on. Like in Japan, there are these Hanko seals. We talk about Japan and Hawaii have I don't have to tell you, very, very strong connection. A lot of Japanese Americans living here. And so through the Hanko seals and other ivory sales, it has tied Japan to the brutal elephant ivory trade. Explain how, because a lot of people don't associate Japan with the ivory trade. So if you can, explain how Japan has made some moves to limit it, but ultimately you're seeking a lot more from them and before they open their doors to the 2020 Olympics.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I'd just like to step back a little bit historically, if I may, but, the ivory trade has been with us for a long, long time. There used to be elephants in northern Africa. We all heard of Hannibal and his trips over the Alps. Well, there were elephants in northern Africa at that time. They were wiped out by a combination of trade for ivory, but also climate changes. And then in the colonial times, the major market for ivory was the United States and the UK. We're using it for billiard balls and hairbrushes and all kinds of things. And so that colonial largely wiped out the elephants of West Africa. And then the what I call the first Ivory War, 1975 to 1989, that was half of Africa's elephants, remaining elephants, were then lost. So we went from 1.5 to 750,000 elephants in the course of 20 years. And most of that ivory was actually heading to Japan. And as you mentioned, these hankos, these name stamps, which are used on all kinds of official documents in Japan, it's changing now with digitization and things that the actual hankos themselves are becoming kind of obsolete. But these little stamps were never traditionally made of ivory. They're made of jade and all kinds of other things. But in the 70s and 80s, as the Japanese economy exploded, people started using ivory for it, and it became the main consumption item. And literally half of Africa's elephants disappeared through a legal trade, which was basically being used to launder all the poached animals into Japan. So a lot of Japanese ivory is kind of old ivory, which is part of the last crisis that we had. The last ivory war, the second one, which is went from 2008 up to 2017, there was China and the Chinese demand that was driving it. But what we now have in Japan is we have a lot of ivory. Some of it is going legally to China, a large amount. The government has tried to regulate it, but they only got like 25% of what they know is there. People came forward with it. So it's a total mess. But the big picture thing is Singapore just announced last week they were ending it. Hong Kong has ended the ivory trade. China has ended the ivory trade. US has ended the ivory trade. UK has ended the ivory trade. For the first time in history, we're looking at a potential end to the legal ivory trade across the planet if we can get Japan out. And when you look back at the ivory trade, it has been an abject disaster. It was linked very closely with slavery, the slave trade. Essentially, the economics were that you needed to bring ivory and slaves together. So the slaves carried the ivory, then you sold the slaves and the ivory, and the two businesses went hand in hand. They were economically linked. Horrible, horrible history behind it. And then we had situations such as Angola and Mozambique. Ivory was being used to finance the civil wars there. More recently, the People's Liberation Army, Joseph Kone, has used ivory to finance it. So it's a really nasty business. And every time they tried to regulate it, they found ways of smuggling stuff in and putting it in between. So we now have, the first time in history, only one major country left selling ivory legally, and that's Japan. And many of the Japanese people we've spoken to, as high as the First Lady, had no idea this was going on, had no idea that Japan had this role within the ivory trade, and are very, very supportive of just ending it. So we're very hopeful in the run-up to the Olympics that the Chinese government will join the world community. And there has been a UN request that countries stop these domestic sales. And as I say, every major country is now out except Japan. And that Japan join the international community and let's end ivory trade forever and let's move on.
What can people consider? That is probably the country that has the strongest connection to the most number of people who are listening right now. What can you tell these people to do to put pressure on Japan?
Well, you can first of all write to anybody, the Japanese tourism, the Japanese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You can go to hashtag One Year To Go at WildAid on our Twitter and show your support there. And you can communicate to the Japanese public to tell their government that we don't need this anymore. We've moved on. We don't want to be the last country legally trading ivory in the world. And that is very much the sentiment of the public, of the people that we talk to in Japan. This is something which is, again, it's a small-scale activity. Many people have ivory tusks that their parents or their grandparents bought in the 70s and 80s, almost like a bar of gold. They had it as an asset they saw as a hedge, maybe worrying about currency deflation and all that. And it's sitting in people's attics. It's just lying there. And the fear in the long run is that if the demand comes up again and resurgence, then we'll suck in new ivory and continue the trade. But really what we send a message is that elephants have value being alive. They are very valuable tourist assets. Killing them for their ivory is not a business, and it's not something we should do any longer. So we're not generally in favor of boycotts, but I do think as we come up to the Olympics, we are trying to say to the Japanese government, look, this is not what you want to have on your copy sheet when you're just about to host the world and a globally important event. And in fact, we did a huge amount of work around the Beijing Olympics, which was actually very positive. We had a whole sharpening campaign and things like that. We did that with the Chinese government. It was very positive. One of the Olympic themes is environment and globalism and things like that. So it just seems to make sense that now this trade. It's the right time. It's the right time to make the announcement go. And anything anyone can do to encourage the Japanese government, I think at this time is the way to go about it.
And other ways that people can support WildAid, from stock donations, legacy gifts, corporate matching, in-kind donations, partnerships. Do you want to give a plug for any of that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. All of the above. If you go to our website, www.wildaid.org, you can see all of those above. It all helps out. And, you know, we are in a pretty nice position that we have a foundation which basically gives us support, which covers all our general administration and fundraising. So all of our money donated by the public is able to go directly to programs.
And this is an organization, again, that has excellent Charity Navigator rating. That's something we talk about a lot for our own station when we're on the air, Obviously, to make sure people realize what we're financially responsible with their contributions. And WildAid has a 4 out of 4, correct? That's what your rating is?
Yeah.
Here's how to get in touch with this organization, wildaid.org. At their website, you can make a secure donation online. You can learn about the crises that they're handling with a variety of animals, many that we did not cover, around the world that are in deep trouble. You can find a contact form there at their website to send an email or reach out to them to get ideas or if you have a question. You can call them and reach their headquarters in San Francisco at 415-834-3174. You can find the full interview, the radio feature, all their contact information, and all of our previous Helping Hand guests online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look for Helping Hand in the pull-down menu. Peter, are there closing thoughts from you, something I didn't cover relating to these two issues, or anything else you want to get in the ear of folks who are driving home who are concerned about these issues?
No, I think, look, the situation for pangolins is particularly dire right now, but we do have solutions. If the Chinese government could do exactly what they did for ivory, it would be a whole game changer, and China could lead the movement to save the pangolins. In regards to ivory, we're so close to ending this historically tragic trade, and it would just be so wonderful if Japan would join everyone else in the world and move us forward, and then we can then have the time and energy to look at some of the other tougher issues in many ways, like the climate change and like the habitat loss. We can't afford to lose these animals. We're losing part of ourselves in the process, and so we have to stand and fight for them.
It is a global conservation organization on the front lines of trying to change behavior throughout the world, and in particular right now in the Asia Pacific, and it's WildAid, they're called. Peter Knight's their CEO. You may have seen some of their campaigns with the slogan, "When the buying stops, the killing can too," and a number of celebrities who have been empowered to support them. On behalf of all the little pangolins that you're going to divert somebody chasing them, and all the elephants that hopefully are going to live through this and keep their tusks and keep their babies and continue to live, thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you so much for taking the time to be on Helping Hand with me.
Thank you, Dave. You've done your research. Very good.